sound is.
Γεια σου ρε Νίκ, χαθήκαμε, we're back.
How are you, Tom? It's been too long, my friend.
It has been far too long. Great to be back, everyone, after a bit of a hiatus, which, unsurprisingly, was brought about by COVID.
Yeah, it was the Omicron virus we copped, and yeah. We had turns. I think you went first, and then it went through my family, yep. And I was isolated for a good 2-3 weeks.
Yep.
Because we timed it perfect. My son got it first, then I got it, then my younger son got it, so... Yeah, tough times being in isolation.
Yeah, I tell you what, I got it on New Year's Eve. So New Year's Day, I was stuck in my bedroom in isolation. On New Year's Day, drinking Greek coffee off the floor in front of the mirror because I didn't have anything to lean on.
Tom, I cracked up that photo that you sent me. Shall we put it on Facebook?
Maybe the man boobs were sort of sticking out in that photo, but...
It was a classic. Sitting down, like you look really sad, sipping your coffee.
I know. But I got the flurry in the Vasilopita. So I'm sitting there, you know, drinking coffee, eating Vasilopita and thinking, you know, lucky me, you know, I've started the year off well and got the flurry, thinking things can only go up from here.
And it definitely has, mate. Definitely has. But look, the virus, it wasn't that bad. I think it was more daunting seeing that second line on that rapid antigen test. As soon as you saw that, oh, fuck, I got COVID. But really, it wasn't that bad. I've had flus and colds a lot worse. So.
I think that seems to be the general consensus for people that I know anyway. For me, I was sick for about a day or so, and then, it was fine after that. You know, I was painting my outdoor furniture 2 days in. So it was quite lucky. Other people, unfortunately, you know, didn't have as good a time. We're thinking of you guys, and obviously keep safe. We're thinking of everyone out there, you know, who are in different states of, no longer lockdown, but different states of restrictions at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it is, I hear you, Tom. Sentiments to everyone out there who has copped COVID in a bad way. We're lucky, I guess. It wasn't that bad, but restrictions are slowly peeling off, and we're in a good place, I think.
I think so.
Here in Sydney, so we're on the way up.
Absolutely.
And more importantly, we are back.
We are back. Episode 7. We really need to thank our sponsors in Mooch and Me Cafe and Meet the Greek Restaurant, which is now back open if you're in Sydney. Make sure you call 9597-5062 for bookings. Fantastic Greek food and, you know, fantastic coffee at Mooch and Me as well. Now, Nick, our guest today, I'm incredibly excited because we're talking music today, a subject that's really close to my heart as a musician myself. You're into music, obviously. What sort of bands do you like?
I love music, Tom, as you know, but I actually envy musicians. I wish I could do what you guys do. Music, for me, puts me in a really good headspace. So if I hear a song as well, it puts me into a... it takes me back to a place where I had good memories, and it's always a positive thing. When I went backpacking around Europe, I'd hear a song, you know, I might hear a song 20 years later, but it'll take me to that place.
Yeah.
And I remember the smells and how I felt at that time. And definitely, even at work, if I'm working as well, I'll put the headphones on, I'll put some classical music, it'll just take me to a beautiful place and a really good mindset, and away I go. But definitely. As for bands, look, I chop and change a lot. It depends what mood I'm in.
I'm the same, as my genre. Yeah, I'm the same.
Yeah, so I don't really have a specific band.
Very
but
good.
That's it, mate.
That's all right.
Music takes me to a beautiful place. That's
absolutely
why I love it.
Soundtrack to our lives, as they say. Well, we're very fortunate, as you said, we have the great Greek-Australian composer and orchestrator George Ellis with us right here in the distillery. For those who don't know George, you only think you don't know him because chances are you've heard some of his work already. He works across a variety of styles, including symphonic music, choral, opera, musical theatre, jazz and pop. And has presented concerts conducting in Paris, London, Amsterdam, Brussels, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, Los Angeles, Athens, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, while also performing in every capital city in Australia.
Wow.
He's classically trained at the doctoral level in Australia and the USA and experienced in performing pop rock music. George has made a career of combining symphony orchestras with popular artists. These include... and brace yourself, Lou Reed, The Church, Megan Washington, Josh Pike, Sneaky Sound System, Art vs. Science, Human Nature, Augie March, Ganga Jang, Guy Sebastian, Paulini, David Campbell, John Williamson, Marsha Hines, Alex Lloyd, Deborah Conway, Claire Bowditch, John Paul Young, Jimmy Little, Troy Cassadaly, I'm not done yet, Doug Parkinson, Grace Knight, Jade McRae, Jeff Duffy, Felicity Urquhart, and Don Spencer. But it doesn't stop there, Nick. Okay. George's career has included Olympic opening ceremonies, arts and cultural festivals, opening nights, ARIA awards, and sporting finals such as the NRL and Davis Cup. But there's more to George Ellis than his work on the big stage. He also loves working in conducting, composition and film, orchestrating and arranging music, theatre and opera, education concerts with the George Ellis Orchestra. As a side note, he's also had a portrait of himself on display at the New South Wales Art Gallery as a finalist in the 2007 Archibald Prize.
Legend.
Which won People's Choice Award in Sydney and Melbourne. I'm out of breath. George, welcome to Uzo Talk.
I'm 230 years old.
How have you
had
the time?
I feel very tired listening to all of that.
How much have you done in your life?
Look, I'm very, very, very blessed. I'm just, I made a decision a while ago. We can explore that. But just in a nutshell, I made a decision a while ago now, when I was in my early 20s, to pursue music education, to study music. I'd already been playing music, but and I'm not getting into specifics yet, but a while ago I remember saying, right, you've tried other things, they haven't really worked, go and study music. And right. I did. I struggled. I worked hard to audition to get into the Conservatorium of Music in Sydney. I didn't think I'd get in. They were taking a very few people from a large pool of people who auditioned. And long story short, I passed the audition. And I remember, even before I started, I remember thinking, this is, I think, a good thing.
Yeah.
I think this is going to mean that I will have a rewarding career. You know, regardless of the achievements or the financial reward or anything, I thought to myself, it'll be something that when you do it, it'll give you satisfaction. It'll be pleasurable if you can make it work to earn a living doing this. And I mean, little did I know that it would be what you've just read out. And of course, as you read it now in a minute or two, I go, yes, that's right, I did that. But we're talking over 33 years, and it just is kind of like a little, it's like when you turn a page in a book, it's just one page at a time, you're not really noticing. And then, after 200 pages, you look back and, oh, okay, it was that much. So it's a little bit like that. But even though it was a good thing that I started learning music and on my road to music education and my career, I feel very, very lucky, blessed, fortunate to have done what I've done, and the people that I've met, and my greatest joy, and we can get into this specific, my greatest joy is working with the brilliantly talented people that I work with. And you mentioned my orchestra. The great thing about that is I get to choose who's in my orchestra.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't do this 20 years ago because, I didn't know people. But having been around and working with orchestras, I say, oh, can you come and work with me, please? Can you come and work with me, please? Can you come and work with me, please? I mean, last night we did a concert at the State Theatre. I had a 30-piece orchestra in front of me, hand-picked by me, and saying, okay, from, experiences together, from working with Alex Lloyd and with David Campbell and et cetera. I go, I'm putting an orchestra together, want to come and work with me? So that's and that didn't happen in a day or a month or two. It's happened over 30 years.
Yeah, of course.
Here's where we are, and I feel very fortunate.
Well, I can tell you, we feel absolutely honored to have you in here today, George. After all that, I think it's definitely time that we take a drink. So, Nick, what do you reckon? Is it time to start formally?
It's time, mate. It's time.
All right, let's
raise your glass.
Yamas. Cheers.
Welcome, George.
All right, Nick, what are we drinking today, mate?
Tom, we are drinking Ouzo. That's spelled 00.
It's a different kind.
It is.
This is a really special one, isn't it?
Very special. Look, our good friends, Nico Economos reached out to us. He's been listening to our podcast and said how much he loved it, and he had opened up a distillery in Adelaide, would you believe, of all places, and he made ouzo here in Australia.
Yeah. It's very nice.
It is very nice, isn't
it? I'm really loving this.
So Adelaide Distillery is the place. As Nick said, Nick and his uncle Peter are the ones who actually started this, and I think they specialize, they said, in malt whiskey particularly, but they've created a gin off the back of that. And also an ouzo now, which is fantastic.
I'm buying shares in the company.
I think so.
I like gin and ouzo. There you go.
And he's got single malt whiskey as well, which is, in my view, that's my winter drink, single malt whiskey. Yes. And summer is my gin and ouzo. So he's covered my four seasons.
your whole year. That's it.
Yeah, I'm alcoholic.
I'm not far behind you.
Classic. No, look, great drop. I love the taste of the aniseed and the cloudy colour as soon as you put your ice cubes in and a touch of water.
Yeah.
It's really good. And more importantly, there's no added sugar or preservatives.
Is that right?
So dare I say, is this healthy for us, Tom? What do you think? George?
There's no question. No question. Very
healthy. That's healthy for you.
Yes. I mean, aniseed comes from the ground, doesn't it?
It does.
So it's got to be healthy.
Naturally occurring.
Bit of water. Yeah. No added sugar or preservatives.
Well, they say drink 2 liters of water a day. We're contributing.
That's it.
We're on our way.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is, this actually has more of that botanical taste. You know, kind of similar to the Votanikon that we tried the other week, the gin. Yeah, it's kind of got like a gin quality to it in some strange way, but it's really nice.
Yeah,
I agree.
I hear you. It's more than just ouzo. It seems like there's a touch of something else in there. But maybe Nico and Pete might want us to know what the secret is.
I doubt it. Well, we thank Adelaide Distillery for sending these through to us. And guys, make sure you look them up online. You know, support them. They're doing great work over there, particularly their whiskey. We haven't tried it yet, but...
Hint.
Apparently it's sold out. Well, it's sold out apparently.
They've done
such a good job of it that it's all gone. The boys are obviously doing a fantastic job.
They're doing something right, that's for sure.
And we can find it at general liquor stores?
I'm not sure, actually.
Because I'm going looking.
Yeah, look, even if you Google them, Adelaide Distillery, they'll pop up. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And one thing I like about it as well, it's free shipping as well on all purchases in Australia. There's nothing worse than you see a price and then you've got to add shipping and everything else. This is free shipping. So, boys, nice. You're onto something really good.
You are. Well, thank you very much to Adelaide Distillery for being part of this particular podcast. I think it's time we get into the formal discussion. So... George, tell us a little bit about your Greek family history. Where's your family from originally?
So my parents were born in Alexandria, Egypt, when there was a large Greek population there. My grandparents were born there as well. From my mother's side, my great-grandparents were from Smyrna.
Mm.
And from my father's side, from Constantinople.
Wow.
So Izmir and Istanbul. So they migrated to Alexandria. In the late 19th, early 20th century. And my parents were born there in the late 30s. And, it became difficult in the 1950s for people not native to Egypt to live there, taxes, etc. And my father knew people out here in Sydney.
Yeah, right.
And so his friend said, come over, it's a great place. So in 1956, he and my mother came out, and 3 boys later, we're here. 3 sons later for them, that is, my two brothers and I. We were born in the 60s.
Wow.
Where did they settle once they came to Australia?
So the friend that I was talking about, also originally from Alexandria, lived in Norwood, and so they lived with him and his wife for
great,
a little
Greek
while.
Community there in Norwood as well. Mm.
Yes, there were. That's right. And but my father, he found a job at the Redfern Mail Exchange for Australia Post, whatever it was called back then, Australian Post Office or GPO, I think. Anyway, so he wanted to buy a house, but he couldn't afford. In the city, so he moved. He found a house in St. Mary's, and having grown up in Alexandria, which is on the coast, my mother especially and my father loved the beach. The beach, and so when he bought a house in St. Mary's, she got in the car. He said, "I bought a house. Let's go see it." And she said, "We're going the opposite way." you're supposed to be going that way. He said, no, I couldn't afford that way. We're going that way. Anyway, and no freeway back then, of course, you know. Wow. 2 hours later, she's saying, she's in tears. She's saying, where have you brought me? not that she didn't like the place, but it was like, you know, 2 hours or so from the beach. Anyway, they bought. It was a smart move because he sold that and moved back into the inner west, into Marrickville, and when I was 3. So from 3 years old onwards, I've lived in the inner city, Marrickville and Earlwood and Balmain, and now I'm in Camperdown.
And it's important. It's important here to mention to our non-Australian listeners, all of these communities that you've spoken about, so Marrickville, Earlwood, they all have a very strong connection to the Greek community. And in fact, Marrickville is now called Little Greece.
Right.
So what's your connection to your Greek heritage now, George? Do you go back to Greece at all? Do you have a strong connection? We've seen that you're involved in the Greek Festival of Sydney. So obviously there's some connection.
Yes. Oh, well, look, I'm very connected. I'll go back to Greece as much as they'll let me. last I was there was 2018. I've been about, I think I've lost count, maybe 8 times, 9 wow. times, maybe 10 times to Greece. Mm-hmm. Last time was 2018. I've got cousins that live in Athens, in the little in Gylfatha.
Beautiful.
I've got relatives other parts of Athens and also in Corinth.
Wow. Yeah. I was just going to ask you, sorry, before we jump on, Ellis, what was the Greek
name? Itane Kokorelis. It was Kokorelis.
Wow. Kokorelis.
My father changed it from Stavros Kokorelis to Steve Ellis.
Okay.
So my mother's name is Aliki, so Alice in English, and the last name was changed to Ellis, so she's Alice Ellis. She used to say, I married the wrong man.
Classy. And she didn't live too far from here, I believe.
She lived across the road from here.
Yeah.
Right there.
Right across the road from where we're recording right now. What a, you know,
what a coincidence.
Because when you said, oh, we're recording at the street address, I said, my parents used to live on that street. And you said, where? I said, I think right there. So here we are.
See, it's a very small community here in Sydney, isn't it?
It is, definitely. And I've met your mother, definitely.
She used to be a teacher at Agios Nikolaos, St. Nicholas in Livingston Road, Marrickville, where we were living at the time. Mm-hmm. And she was quite a dynamic teacher. Well, I should say a very dynamic teacher, and she was quite well known around. And so people used to call her Kyria Eli, and because our last name is Ellis, so they thought her first name was Eli. But she was a very... as I said before, dynamic Greek teacher, loves the Greek language, taught ancient Greek as well as modern Greek, taught it to high school level. She did well at school in Alexandria, and she also used to work at the Greek consulate here in Sydney.
Oh, wow.
For fantastic. Many years.
We've met a few people, haven't we?
We did. Yeah, we met a few the other night at the launch of the Greek festival.
We did.
Again, small community. George, what does it actually mean to you to be Greek? It's obviously, again, we've spoken at length in the past about how close-knit this community is globally. Mm-hmm. What does it mean for you personally to have Greek heritage?
I love the duality of being born in a country that you strongly identify with. So Australia, of course, in my case, and speaking English like we are now, understanding the culture of and the general way of living of that country. So, you know, there's Australian music, there's Australian rock music, that's all great. There's football, there's rugby league, there's, you know, all the things that are uniquely Australian. Mm. And at the same time, having roots that are not part of that. So to have this other rich, very, very rich culture of Greek in a place where they're separate, but in us being Greek Australians, they're not separate, they're like one. And you're Greek, you're Australian, you're neither Greek nor Australian by themselves, but you're both of them at the same time, and that's very unique.
Yeah.
I did go to school in Marrickville where there was a large Greek community, so there were other Greeks, so I didn't feel excluded, I didn't feel left out. Obviously, you know, growing up, you know, as a dark-haired and dark-skinned boy when I was growing up, there were, you know, blonde boys and girls and blue eyes, and I was thinking, oh, sure, you know, that's an attractive thing. But and I was thinking, oh, well, you know, I live in Australia, I should look like them. But increasingly as I got older, I fell in love with my Greek heritage, my Greek roots. And then, you know, when SOCOG were looking for a conductor to conduct at the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, they wanted somebody who had a working knowledge of Greek, because the Greek language, because the, as you know, the Olympic Games, of course, we all know, started in Greece, and the first modern Olympics were in Athens in 1896. And for those games, the Olympic anthem, the Olympic hymn, was written by Greeks, a composer, Palamas and Somaros. They wrote this piece of music in Greek. So in every Olympic opening games ceremony, this piece has been performed more often in Greek than any other language, sometimes in English, sometimes in French, sometimes in Russian. But Sydney wanted to do it in Greek.
Right.
So when the call came out to find somebody who had professional orchestral and choral conducting experience and could also speak Greek, SOCOG said, how are we going to find somebody like that? and luckily, I went to school with a lovely girl called Agnes, who's good friends with Deborah Sintras, Deborah Galanos. She's a well-known actress. And Agnes told Deborah, who was on the so-called committee, the Millennium Heritage Committee, Agnes told her about me, and SOCOG said, what, there's a professional conductor who speaks Greek? Get him over here. So anyway, that's all to say how fortunate I am that I've got these Greek roots, because I love Greek culture. Especially, I mean, I love it over there when I'm in Greece, but I love it over here because it's not really where the Greek culture's from, but it's in our lives, in my life, definitely. It's part of the fabric now. And yeah, it's just such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And getting the work that I did with SOCOG, and therefore getting into Greek music, I knew about Theodorakis and the other great orchestral Greek composers from the past, but it wasn't just a working knowledge anymore.
Yeah,
I dove right into the depth of it, and I've discovered Mikis Theodorakis' music I think I know his music better than any other composer, as in better than I know him more than Mozart or more than Beethoven or more than Beatles even. And Theodorakis and Manos Chazidakis and Stavros Xarchakos and Yanis Markopoulos. I could go on with these brilliant Greek composers, and I have been performing this music since the Olympics in 2000 here in Sydney, and I can't get enough of it.
Wow. Mm. Just briefly about the Olympics, what did it feel like for you personally to be a person of Greek descent who has been asked to arrange and be part of this particular event in your family's adopted country, I mean, you know, to some degree? That must have been insane. That must have been an insane feeling to think, I am part of something so big that is deeply connected to my roots. Can you try and put that into words?
I think you just did. I'm not sure I can. I mean, I know the feeling, but I think it's fantastic that they wanted a Greek conductor.
Absolutely.
You know, a Greek Australian conductor.
Is this some sort of a connection?
I know this is a podcast, but words are failing me. Kind of puts paid to the...
That says it all.
Is that the user talking to
not yet. Not yet. We'll get there.
So, George, how did you feel? So you got this Greek heritage. Was there some sort of connection with the music? You know, I understand when you feel music, it comes out of you. And what was there some sort of connection there?
I mean, the opening lyrics of the Olympic hymn are Archeon Pnevmathanato, you know, ancient athanato, so ancient spirit, immortal.
Mm.
I mean,
wow.
I mean, I know those words, but I took them to my mother across the road here, yeah. And I said, "Okay, I've got a working knowledge of this, but you're an expert. Take me through this." I mean, and I don't mean just literally translate. Mm-hmm. Do that too, but tell me about this. Like, help me understand. I want to drink these lyrics, this text. Even just the words "adheon pnevma athanaton." It's just, I don't know how I can tell you what the sound of that means. I mean, you know, when we say, and English is a beautiful language, but when we say ancient spirit, immortal, that's fine. That's they're lovely words. But when you hear it in Greek, yeah. I don't know if it's because I've got Greek blood or whether they're just objectively beautiful. Yeah. It does something to me, just like music does. And I guess that's an interesting connection. When you listen to music that really moves you, like emotionally, like, you know, even tears down your face, it's not too far different to listening to or experiencing the sound of the Greek language.
Yeah.
They're both very, very poetic, both very musical. The language is musical and the music is poetic.
Yeah.
So to be there, you know, here in Sydney in 2000, just a little over 100 years after the first modern Olympics, and here are all these, you know, native and white Australians and all the multicultural backgrounds that we have here in this lovely, amazing country. But there I was as part of that, but from the Greek angle.
Yeah.
And we were here, you know, there was the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, who's made up predominantly of Australians, the Millennium Heritage, the Millennium Choir, predominantly Greeks, these two bodies working together. And we've got Symphony Orchestra, which is really Western based, and we've got Greek words and a choir, which is Greek based. And I'm both of those things. I've got the Western culture because I was born in a Western country, but the heritage is non, you know, it's Greek. And so those two things together were just, we practiced for the opening ceremony for 11 months. We started in October 1999, and it was in the ceremony was in September 2000. We worked and worked and worked really hard. We wanted it to be the most magical experience. And on the day, I remember, you know, the music, you know, we started the music, the orchestra started first, and I brought in the choir. And all I saw was there were 200 in the choir, 200 faces full of expression, brightness, singing their hearts out as if every cell in their body was just, you know, orgasming.
Electrifying.
And a kind of a side note, two little side notes, if I may, about the opening ceremony.
Yeah, that's what we want to hear.
I remember one a little bit deeper, the other one a little more flippant. The deeper one was, I remember being led out. See, we had two dress rehearsals before the opening ceremony. Ceremony was on Friday, but we had a dress rehearsal on the Monday and the Wednesday. And stage managers led us out to where I was to conduct. And I remember the Monday rehearsal was not in front of many people, Wednesday not many people, but on the Friday, the actual ceremony, there were 120,000 people because the Olympic Stadium had the northern and southern stands there, which are not there anymore. But
so that was the rehearsal, was it?
This now we're going to the actual ceremony, and I'm led out to the ceremony on the Friday, and the stage manager says, "Just wait here, and then when we'll tell you, we'll lead you over to the stage and onto the conducting podium." And I remember looking out. It was dark, but there were lights. Everybody had flashes. And I remember saying to myself, "Remember this moment forever. This is what you've wanted. This is what you've wanted, you know, since you started." And it just was a feeling of gratitude, of overwhelming feeling of being in the moment and remembering the moment. And obviously I still do. That's one thing. The other thing that happened was in the two dress rehearsals, when I finished my piece, I was led off by a stage manager and they said, look, for the dress rehearsal, we'll lead you off, but for the actual ceremony, you're to lead yourself off. So I said, okay, sure. When I was led off in the two dress rehearsals, there were only the orchestral musicians up there and the choir was there and I just walked off. That was led off. But in the actual ceremony, after I finished conducting my piece, I'd noticed a spare chair right next to the steps that led up to the cauldron, which Kathy Freeman was to light. We didn't know it was Kathy Freeman until then. They didn't tell us in the dress rehearsal.
Know either.
Yeah, no, in the dress rehearsal they didn't tell us. They said it's going to be it's a secret, it's a surprise. So I finished the piece and as I'm walking off, because, you know, I'm not being led off, I was going by myself, I saw a seat and I said to the orchestra, is anybody sitting there? They said no, so I just sat there. I thought, I'm going to get in so much trouble. Luckily nobody said anything.
So you had a bird's eye view of the opening ceremony and the lighting of the flames.
Wow. Kathy Freeman, and she got a big cheer as soon as it was revealed it was her, came up like almost as close as you are to me. I could have put my foot out and tripped her.
Like, well, it's funny you say that because there was an incident,
there
wasn't
was. It? Yeah, that's
Kathy
right.
Freeman.
Yes, that's right. The what, are you talking about the cauldron being
locked? That's right. And the flames didn't light up. And,
somehow, luckily there was a second computer which they made it happen, so luckily the cauldron kept on going, but she walked right by me. I wasn't supposed to be there. I was supposed to be backstage, and I thought to myself, I'm probably going to get in a lot of trouble, but this is an opportunity of a lifetime. I don't want to be, you know, in a dressing room and seeing it on a small monitor. I want to see this in person. So I did.
So George, you're telling us you crashed the Olympic ceremony. you were on the field when you shouldn't have been on there.
I crashed it.
That's usually a $10,000 fine nowadays.
Lucky you weren't streaking.
But might have got in more trouble than what I did.
What a classic. So you sat there, she ran like, 2 meters past you?
Yep, just there.
She had to run past a Greek god like yourself, and she didn't stop.
It was a funny moment. It was a funny moment. Classic. I said, are you sure it's okay for me to be here? They said, we don't care.
Yeah.
I'm sure if it was a producer right there, they would have said, get off now.
Who's he? What's he doing? But you were also involved in the Athens Olympics too.
Yes, so for the closing ceremony of the Sydney Olympics, we performed a wonderful work by Mikis Theodorakis called Tis de Geosinisi Lienoite from a great oratory of his called Axionisti. And the Athens Olympic committee were there in Sydney because they knew they were hosting in 4 years' time. So they were working out what they were going to be doing for Athens, and they saw our performance of this Mikis Theodorakis work and they invited us to go over. So I did go over to 4 years later with the choir to train to teach them the music that they were to do for the Athens Olympics. We did that. We did that in Corinth for 2 months. We rehearsed there, and then we got the bus up to Athens, and then the Athens conductor took over from there. So it was a lovely experience to be involved with those Olympic Games, and I got to experience Athens or Greece for 2 months. So
unbelievable,
fantastic! And the two Olympics. That's awesome.
And many people would argue, I mean, the people in this room would probably argue, Sydney Olympics and Athens Olympics. My God.
Two of the best.
Best ever.
I remember, I didn't know I was going to be involved in the Sydney Olympics, and I remember there was talk of if you rented your house out, you could get a lot of money. So my then wife and I thought, we'll do that. And then I got a job at the opening ceremony, and we said, okay, well, I'll do that, and then we'll rent a house out. But then I got a job for the closing ceremony, so we stayed. And Sydney was just such a magical time in September 2000.
I lived it. It went through it. It was an amazing time.
Wasn't it great?
Yeah. I was going to ask you, so just Be a bit more descriptive what you did in Sydney Olympics.
So, what else was it? There was another piece by a Melbourne composer called Chong Lim called Journey of Angels. Mm-hmm. And that was when the Olympic athletes were coming out, the country by country. So Absolutely. The whole time they were coming out, I was conducting his piece called Journey of Angels.
Wow. And how many in the orchestra?
The orchestra was 100. It was the Sydney Symphony Orchestra was 100, and in the choir was 200, so 300 people.
So you managed both, the orchestra and the choir at the same time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I love that. I don't mind smaller ensembles, but for me, the bigger, the better. I love a big orchestra and a big number of people in the choir, yeah.
So I've got a lot of questions on that. So, okay, conducting. So obviously you're holding a baton.
Yes.
Does everyone look at you when you're doing it, when you're conducting?
It's a very good question. I get asked that a lot. We rehearse very hard to get to the performance stage and the mm-hmm. performance level. There's a lot of work that goes into it beforehand. And that's where there's a lot of stopping and starting, talking and fixing and changing. Let's have the trumpets softer. Let's have the violas louder. All that balance thing. Sopranos, you're a little bit out there. Let's work that out. Basses, et cetera, et cetera. Because they're constantly looking up and and in rehearsal and looking at how we're beating and keeping it together, the performance... if you've done your job well, the performance is plain sailing. Mm-hmm. Orchestral musicians, just to make sure that they're not lost in their music, because mm-hmm. you know, in rehearsal you stop and start, you're at bar 5 and then you get a bar 7 and you stop. Mm-hmm. So you know, you're looking up all the time into your music, but in performance there's not going to be a stop at bar 7, right? Nobody wants a song to stop after it started, right? So they're continuing, and so they can afford to look up a little bit, but they have to keep on looking at the music as well, otherwise they'll lose their place. Yeah. So
wow. Yeah. Okay. So you use your baton and your hand and eye contact.
Yes.
So sometimes they look at you to see that they're in tune, they're in sync with everyone else.
Yes, and particularly, I mean, not necessarily much in the middle of a piece, but at the beginning.
Yeah.
At the ending, and when there's a pause, or if there's what we call an accelerando, of course, which is getting faster, or a rallentando, which is getting slower, all of those events that I call them. And there's not a lot of events in each piece. There, you know, might be 4, 5, 6, 7 events.
Sure.
But the beginning and the opening and the ending being 2 of them. Other than that, if it's plain sailing and it's a 4-4 beat and, you know, there's no tempo shift, that is, it doesn't get faster or slower, then, you know, there's not a necessity for them to look up. But as soon as there's an event, let's say there's a pause, you know, if they're holding and they're pausing, they can only go on the conductor's cue.
Oh, wow.
So that kind of thing.
So it's a massive part. It's a big part you play. Otherwise, everything will be out of sync.
Yeah, out of time, sure. Yeah, wow. They're the things. But that's what you rehearse for. You know? You work those things out in rehearsal. If you don't, then it's not a good rehearsal.
Well, I've got a question about conducting.
Yes.
When I watch orchestras and I pay attention to the conductor,
yes,
am I right in saying that you're maybe a bar or so ahead of where the music is?
You're giving every instruction you give is one beat before.
Right, okay.
So, for example, if the orchestra comes in on beat 1, and we're talking about a 4-4 bar, so 1-2-3-4-1, if they're coming in on 1, you have to give 4.
Right.
4-1. So it starts like this.
Do that again.
1-2-4-1. You have to move one beat before.
Yeah.
Because if you go 1, that's not enough. Yeah. That's not enough information in enough time. Mm. So everything we do is one beat before.
So really what you're doing is far more difficult than anyone really realizes, because you're constantly ahead of the music. And that must be so difficult to be able to be listening to it and to be ahead of it at the same time.
Some people say that you have to do it you have to do three things, and that is you have to be in the future, and by that I mean give four when you know it's actually going to affect on one. Be in the present to know that it's what's happening is you have to realize what's happening, and then as it's happened, you're kind of thinking back, think, was that right?
Yeah.
So you're actually in three tenses, part of past, present, future at once. Mm. I don't know if it's just that I've gotten used to it, but it's like when you're 12 months old and you're learning to walk, it's a struggle, but it's not a struggle for us anymore, right?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing.
So it's like riding a bike.
But it's funny, you know, the very first time I did it, I'll just a little bit of a digression in terms of conducting. When I was a student at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, this subject called conducting was thrust upon us. You know, it had to be something that I took. And so our lecturer showed us how to conduct, and we're waving our arms around. We don't know what we're doing. And then we had to do it in front of the rest of the students one at a time, and I went first.
Yeah.
And I start this music, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I'm lost in the music completely. All of a sudden, the musician stopped because a piece came to an end, unbeknownst to me, and I've lifted my arms up in the air as if there's a music was supposed to go on, and they've stopped. Anyway, the lecturer says, "See how George did that? He kept his music. His hands up in the air. That's exactly the right thing to do." I said, "It is?"
Yeah.
I thought to myself, that was a complete fluke. So he's saying to me and to the class, "Oh God, that's really, really great conducting." I'm going, "Oh God, I fluked that one."
Top of the class.
So he
squashed you to the Olympics.
So he encouraged me to keep on conducting, and luckily he did, because I did take to it in the end. And so anyway, I like this these days. I like to know that I am in the music. Know where it is.
Brilliant. I was just going to say, with the baton as well, does it, because sometimes you might do a concert for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Does it matter the weight of the baton? Your shoulders get sore.
Is that the right name for it? Baton?
Yeah, baton. Baton. Actually, baton? It's just a French word for stick.
Yeah, right.
Oh, okay.
So some people call it a stick.
Okay. It's like a drum stick.
Yeah. Okay. No, they're light. Mine is made out of wood. There are many that are made out of fiberglass. I've had fiberglass ones, but I prefer the wooden ones. Mm-hmm. They're light. And the only reason to use them is you can conduct without a baton. Some conductors do conduct without one.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like if it's a big orchestra, you know, the percussionist or the brass players up the back, it's just a little bit clearer. Obviously, the violins and the cellos that are right near you, if you're conducted without a baton, that's fine. But with it, it's better for the people that are further behind.
And you get hot up there in the suit. I could imagine the lights and...
I did a concert last night. It was a Fleetwood Mac orchestrated concert at the State Theatre. And I do expend quite a bit of energy, but I'm embarrassed to say my shirt was soaking wet at the end of the night. So, yeah, I do.
A sign of a good gig.
I don't have a gym membership, so this is in lieu of that.
Don't need it, yeah. I can imagine it'd be quite tense up there, hot, and your hands are going.
The lights are hot. Yeah, and I wear jackets, so it does get hot back there. But I'm okay with that. You know, being Greek, I think I'm okay with hot weather.
Yeah, exactly. Do you ever talk through it? Like, would you say the trombone guy isn't blowing hard enough? Would you say something and say, "Come on, Ralph, blow harder"? Or
in rehearsal, absolutely. All the time, yeah. In concert, or you can only use gestures. So if, you know, if the trombone needs to be louder, I'll look at him or her and gesture to them to play louder.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the gesture to...
To play louder is this, to play softer is this.
Okay, hand up pointing to the sky.
That's right, it's for stronger, and like this is for softer. Fantastic.
And these are universal gestures as well, are they? Or are they specific to your orchestras?
They're pretty, I mean, everybody does it different. You know, people have their own style, but those two that I just mentioned are pretty universal. Most conductors will
use. Did you just tell us to turn it down just there?
No, turn it up.
Oh, we're getting... Oh, okay.
Where's the knob? Pace. Hang on.
Yeah. Oh, classic. No, it's very fascinating. And when I was younger, I'd go to the opera here and there and so forth.
Oh,
yeah, I loved it.
Oh, really?
But my partner loves La Traviata.
Yeah, that's a great opera.
The Verdi one. And I heard you did that.
Yes, I conducted that. So Sydney. At the opening ceremony, ceremony of the Olympic Games. The person that conducted the Australian national anthem is a conductor. Her name is Simone Young, mm-hmm. and I knew Simone Young from you know, different circles, but I'd never worked with her. And at the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in 2000, she said to me, next year in 2001, I'm conducting La Traviata and I need an assistant. Are you interested?" I said, "Absolutely." So I assisted her for a year at Opera Australia. And one of the pieces we conducted was La Traviata.
Fantastic.
I love that opera.
Yeah. Oh, I've got to take Chrissy. She's been hammering me. She's, "Nick, we've got to see. It's one of my favourite ones." "All right, if it comes out."
Yeah, yeah. It's a very good opera.
Yeah.
And it is a different kind of experience. I remember going to the Sydney Symphony for the first time when I was in high school. And it was the first time that I felt a real connection to music. Hmm. At that point, I'd seen a number of bands. But what is it about symphonies and, you know, that sort of setup that... We're just refilling. That's the sound.
I was trying to be surreptitious about it.
I try to be subtle. Terrible.
We're pretty open about the refills. Oh, okay. George.
All right. It's fill me up then.
What is it about that particular format that has such a great, you know, that people feel more than anything?
With the symphony orchestra, for me, it's all about colour, oral colours. Mm. So... you know, you've got brass instruments, you've got string instruments, you've got woodwind instruments, and they all sound as different to each other as anything else. So, you know, a flute sounds as different to a cello as a French horn does to an oboe or a violin, etc., etc. And it's those colours. It's like, imagine if you can compare it visually, you know, a blank sheet of either all just white or all black, or a bit of white, a bit of black, maybe some grey. But then if you add light blue, if you add yellow, if you add red, or you just any of those colours or all of them, or maybe, you know, everything, green and oranges and purples and... it becomes more interesting. And that's the thing with a symphony orchestra. I mean, I love rock music as much as any rock music lover. And, you know, because it's got... there's a drum beat, there's the electric bass, there's the guitar, there's the keyboard, that's fantastic. But it's another world to have, a violin section.
Yeah.
And then the flute. The flute has this sweet sound. The oboe has this sad sound. The clarinet has this... kind of a circular, bright sound. Mm. And it's the colours to me more than anything. It's the melodies. I mean, Mozart wrote great melodies.
Yeah.
Beethoven wrote amazing melodies. We all know Beethoven's Fifth, right? Mm. Ba-ba-ba-bum. And, but it's not so... It's as much the melody as the media that are performing it, the strings and the clarinet that own that start the beginning of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony have as much to do with it as the actual way the notes go. Yeah. So, in answer to your question, I think that's what people connect with, and. Exploring that a little bit further, I mentioned rock music. When you do add the orchestral colour to rock music, that's a magic combination. And one of the first people to realise that was George Martin, who was the Beatles producer, of course, as we know. And he was classically trained. He'd studied at the Guildhall School of Music in London. And he played oboe, he played piano, and he was a string arranger. And when Brian Epstein, the Beatles' then manager, gave him a demo of the Beatles, he said, "Okay, I'll take them on." And he wasn't sure because it was two guitars, a bass, and drums.
Yep.
So they did start, you know, obviously history tells us that they started working together. But about three or so albums in, Paul McCartney, one of the lead singers and major songwriters of the Beatles, of course, brings in a song called Yesterday, and the others are playing guitar and drums and bass to it, and it's not working. And George Martin says, "I've got an idea. Mm-hmm. I'll write a string quartet for it. I'll bring in two violins, a viola, and a cello player." I mean, which rock band did that before? Yeah. And
they were quite self-conscious about it at that point, weren't they?
Exactly. Absolutely. And it just worked magically. Here was Paul McCartney singing, playing guitar, and two violins, a viola and a cello. So that, I mean, there were other examples before then, but that's kind of the genesis of, you know, marrying classical colors, classical orchestral instrumental colors with popular music.
There's obviously been more examples in more recent times. 1999, Metallica with the San Francisco Symphony, and even the last, I think it was 2018, they did another
SM1 and SM2.
The second one for me was even better because it delved into more orchestral stuff. What did you think of
concerts? Metallica orchestrated. Yeah. Actually, in fact, we did it at the State Theatre a couple of weeks ago.
I went to school with the drummer.
Is that Andreas?
Andreas,
yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
What a powerhouse drummer that guy is. He loudest drummer I've ever heard.
He was unbelievable. There was always... I went to Marcelin College in Randwick, and he was... So when I started high school, I think he was a few years ahead of me.
Yes.
Maybe 3 or 4 years.
Yes, right.
There was always that one drummer in the school who was like... the upper echelon, and he was always at the top. Right, he was unbelievable.
I think it's amazing. I mean, I know it's their one of their most popular songs, and they've got more than one great song, but Enter Sandman, which is the song we finished the concert with, stands to reason.
Yes.
I mean, when you hear Enter, Exit Light, Enter, etc., and the orchestra backs that up with ba, 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 bum, it's just a beautiful synergy of heavy rock music with orchestral color, like I talked about before, and it's a really brilliant marriage.
Were you playing the original Michael Kamen?
Yes,
you were.
We did those same arrangements. Yeah, fantastic. We had to write them out because we couldn't get them, but that's okay.
So you sat there scoring all of this yourself?
My colleagues and I wrote them out ourselves. Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Unbelievable. Just on this point, we're getting into popular music. I just wanted to point this out because I feel as though you and I have had a similar experience in one respect, because I was reading an article about you recently where, I mean, I freaked out when I read it. The earliest conscious memory that I have as a human being is laying on the floor in my grandparents' house with my dad, listening to the Beatles. Mm. So there were records strewn, you know, all across the floor.
Yeah.
I must have been 2 years old. I don't even know. And we were listening to one particular Beatles album, and he handed me the cover, and it was Sgt. Pepper. Mm. And that has stuck with me. It is my earliest memory as a sentient being. I understand that you had a similar experience.
God, I'm getting goosebumps. So I was born in 1964, and in 1967, Sgt. Pepper's came out. In 68, because, you know, I mean, my father didn't grow up with pop and rock music from the West. You know, he's was brought up in Alexandria. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Alexandria. Anyway, but in the 1960s, especially adults, you couldn't have avoid the Beatles. They were just a worldwide phenomenon, as we know. So he's not really into it, but he's tapping into it to see, you know, I don't want to be left out. What is it that everybody finds so wonderful in this? So we had a cassette player at home, a portable one, and he bought a cassette of Sgt. Pepper. I didn't know anything about the Beatles or Sgt. Pepper at the time. I was four.
Yeah.
So he bought it in 1968. And so I, as an inquisitive little four-year-old, I say, Dad, what's that? What's that? He goes, oh, it's music. I don't know if I really like it, but I'd like to see. I said, can I listen to it, please?
How forward-thinking, though? Like, most of the Greeks back then, they were just like...
No.
Yeah. This is not our music.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's right, yeah. No, he bought it. He wanted to see what all the commotion was about, what all the fuss was about. Long story short, I took the cassette as a little kid and into my bedroom, and I worked out how to put it in. I pressed play, and, you know, Sgt. Pepper comes out and then starts, and then with a little help from my friends.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to this, and I'm, as a very, very, very young human being, I'm going, this is doing something to me that I don't quite understand.
I'm tearing up right now.
And it gets to the end of the first side, and I go, okay, wow. I turn it over. And I get to the next side, and then I get to the end of that second side, and I'm just getting more and more like, what on earth is happening to me? Yeah. And I turn it over and I play first sight again. And I don't know how long this lasted, but it was a while. I don't know how many times I turned it over and played side one, played side two, played side one, side two again. By the end of that session, I'm absolutely hooked. I'm delirious with, I can't find the word, whether it's joy or whether it's, I'm for the rest of my life, I'm completely imprisoned. And I know that sounds a negative word, but it's a positive. Like I'm so addicted, eternally, and it's never faded.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, it's gone more. But it started back then, and I had no idea that it would have such an effect on me. I first pressed play, and then I don't know how many hours later.
So who would have thought, Sergeant Pepper?
Yeah,
you two in the room, has it changed your life?
Yes, it did.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the reason why I started playing music as well.
Yeah, I mean, on that album, there are some pretty raunchy, or musically raunchy. But then there's also "She's Leaving Home."
Yeah,
even though the lyrics are about something hard, what a beautiful melody, and Paul McCartney singing that gorgeous interval. Accompanied by harp. I had no idea that it was a harp at the time. I'm four. Yeah. But, obviously I learned later, the harp is one of the most beautiful sounding instruments of all time. Mm. And I'm listening. I have no idea what's going on, but I'm listening to this after the raunchy stuff, and this melodious, gorgeous music comes on. I'm going, I have to hear that song again and again and again. And I still feel like that.
Yeah.
If I hear it now, I'm not going to hear it once. It's like, you think you're going to eat one Dorito. No way. You're eating five or six or more. It's like you press play on "She's Leaving Home." You have to hear it again. At least that's how I feel.
And that's before you even get to things like "Within You" and "Without You." Mm. Who would have thought that a band of that stature would delve into Indian music in that respect?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable to hear that. It must have blown people's minds at that point.
Yeah, well, it certainly blew this four-year-old's mind. Steve Kilby from the church, he was saying, he was talking about some music that was psychedelic, and he said, I hadn't been taking drugs at that point, but when I heard your music, I knew what drugs was going to be like. So I kind of felt like that. Not that it was about drugs for me. It was about being blown away by music.
I don't want to focus too much on the Beatles because I could talk all day about them. But
I've got 16 weeks free. Yeah. Let's start.
but one thing that I've always wanted to discuss with someone who really knows.
Yeah.
The baseline in Getting Better.
Oh my God.
That must be the greatest baseline in the history of humanity. Like for me, who sits there and thinks this is a good baseline for this song?
He's a phenomenon, Paul McCartney. I mean, and to think that he actually sang it at the same time. I mean, when Paul McCartney came out in 2018, I had to go and see him.
I was there.
I had to go. And I struggled to get tickets. I eventually got tickets, almost at the back for the second day. It was a Monday night and a Tuesday night, and I got tickets for the Tuesday night. And then friends of mine said, oh, we've got a spare ticket for the Monday night. Would you like it? And I didn't care. I was willing to pay thousands of dollars for it. So I went both nights. And I went the first night, and it was amazing. It was a historical document as much as anything else, and his tribute to George Harrison. It was just incredible. Yeah. I went the next night, and the person I was with on the second night said to me, do you think it'll be the same concert or will it be, different songs? I said, look, if he starts with Hard Day's Night and then he goes to Junior's Farm, then it's the same concert.
Yeah.
So he starts on the second night with Hard Day's Night. I'm going, oh, I think it might be the same concert.
Yeah.
But the second song instead of Junior's Farm is Jet. I mean, Jet, one of the most brilliant songs by Wings of all time. Yeah. And so from then on, it was a mixture of some of the night before and new songs from the night before. So amazing. I had to go see that. And if he played four or five nights, I would have gone to all four or five nights.
I'm with you. I just got to out my dad really quickly.
Mm.
I'd waited 30-odd years of my life to see a Beatle.
Yes.
I wanted to go see him when he was originally going to come out. When Paul was originally going to come out in the early 2000s and he cancelled.
Yes.
So it was a big deal for me to go to this concert. And I sat with my dad and my wife.
Yes.
And my brother and my mum sat somewhere else.
Right.
I always wanted to be with dad because we shared that moment, you know.
Yes,
with, you know.
Beautiful. How beautiful.
And he comes out the first strum of Hard Day's Night and he kicks into it. And I had my GoPro and I turned around to dad and he's bawling his eyes out. And he just goes like this. He's like, get away from me.
You know, how fantastic.
But that's
what
the connection.
A beautiful moment.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, yeah.
That's the Beatles. I'm going to cry.
Yeah, fantastic. Wow.
Sorry, Nick. We sort of took over there for a moment.
No, that's beautiful. That's great listening to it.
I mean, and look, they set the path for everyone else, really. I mean, you know, they wrote the Rolling Stones' first hit single. Yeah. You know, I Want to Be a Man. I mean, the Beach Boys were highly, I mean, Brian Wilson never stops talking about how much the Beatles influenced him, and you know he was trying to write an album as good as as good as theirs, and he, you know, he comes up with Pet Sounds and Good Vibrations, and then he says, and then Sergeant Pepper came out. What chance do we have?
Unbelievable.
Actually, can I touch on, so when you were younger, sorry to go back to the beginning, you were in a band called Affections, I believe.
Yes.
And you were a bass guitarist. That's is that right. what it was? Did you sing as well?
No, I'm not really, unfortunately, not a singer. I'd love to be a singer, but I don't have my voice isn't that tuneful. It's okay, I can carry a tune, but not enough to be a singer. I sang some backing vocals every now and then.
Okay. And you met some of Australia's best artists, like INXS and Jimmy Barnes, Cole Chisel.
Yes, we were with an agency called the Harbour Agency, and they used to get us gigs at pubs, and we were always support act for bands like Mental as Anything, the Angels, you know, Radiators, and eventually we got picked up by a label called Deluxe Records, owned by Michael Browning, and on the same label, way before they became a worldwide phenomenon, was INXS.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So we were on the same label for a little while as INXS, and that's kind of our only little claim to fame.
Classic.
But one of my favourite gigs was Parramatta Leagues Club, supporting Cole Chisel. And, you know, we played in other places, Caringbah Inn, Sylvania Inn, other places. And, you know, sometimes it was okay and sometimes it wasn't so great, the reaction I'm talking about.
Yep.
But Parramatta Leagues, and we're thinking, oh, God, we're going to go on before Cole Chisel. They're going to hate us. But for some reason, we were on fire. I think I was in year 10 or year 11.
Wow.
We fluked a great gig. It went really well. And we got an encore before Cole Chisel. Wow. It was like amazing. So those are Parramatta Leagues, I remember, 1980.
Wow. So you met Michael Hutchence. Obviously.
Yes, we met Michael Hutchence. Yeah. I tell you the people that were really... There were two occasions, speaking of Australian rock stars, that I remember very well. Mm-hmm. We were supporting Cole Chisel, as I said, at Parramatta Leagues Club.
Yep.
And they were our idols. We loved them. And, we, you know, we're in year 10 or year 11 or something. They're a little bit older than us. And we're over here in Parramatta Leagues Club, the ballroom was quite big. Mm. We're over in this area, and we're looking at them over there going, oh, God, they're our idols. And as we're thinking that, they come over to us, Don Walker, Jimmy Barnes, Ian Moss, they come over and start talking to us. Hey, we hear that you're recording. And we're like, we've lost our tongues. We can't talk. So there was that, which was really nice that they wanted to support us.
Fantastic.
And be beautiful. The other really great support, I remember we were doing a gig at, I think it was the Manly Vale Hotel. We were supporting Moving Pictures. And we're playing and we look over at the side of the stage. The audience is there. We look over at the side of the stage and here was this guy cheering us on, clapping us on, and we're looking over and he's going, you guys sound great. It was Alex Smith, the lead singer of Moving Pictures. And I thought, how wonderful. Instead of being, you know, like, you know, non-communicative with, you know, people who aren't as famous as you or maybe rivals to you, not that we were rivals to them, he was wholly lifting us up, going, yeah. "You guys are great. Keep going. You're fantastic." And I have that's just such a lovely memory of the lead singer of Moving Pictures, who had number one hit singles at the time, "What About Me" and all that.
Yeah,
you know, supporting people, you know, 16, 17 year olds who, you know, didn't have any, you know, singles in the chart or anything like that. So I have those lovely positive memories about my time in the band.
Yeah.
I have a Jimmy Barnes story, actually.
Do you? Tell me.
I do. My band at the time, this was in the early 2000s, were playing a battle of the bands at Cranbrook High School.
Yeah, right.
And his son was going to Cranbrook at the time. Uh-huh. So he got roped into being the judge.
Right. Oh, wow.
So we played and whatever. Anyway, the Cranbrook band came first, unsurprisingly. but he actually came up to me after the gig. He's like, "Oh, you know, you guys were fantastic. What are you doing?" and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But he was really interested in my guitar because I had a Rickenbacker 620.
Love a Rickenbacker.
And he was just like, he's like, "You're like 14, 15 years old. How do you have a Rickenbacker?"
Yeah, yeah. How did you have a Rickenbacker?
This is a story. So my dad, I started playing guitar at 11 years old.
Yeah.
And he and my nonno, my godfather, plays guitar, had said to me, they bought me my first guitar, which was an acoustic guitar, and Dad foolishly said to me, he goes, "If you learn 10 songs," he goes, I'll buy you that Rickenbacker, the electric guitar that you want." And I said, "Okay."
A week later,
I came back to him with 10 songs.
Amazing.
You know, so I played him the 10 songs, and he goes, "Yeah, okay, about that," because I really didn't expect you to be so quick.
Yeah.
"But I will get it for you." He goes, "You know, man of my word." Mm. And he did eventually, a few years later.
Mm.
And Jimmy Barnes is looking at it going, "This is a fantastic guitar." I ended up selling it though, because the sound wasn't working for me, man. Like all guitarists. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Rickenbackers. I mean, the Beatles used it beautifully. I'm a big fan of an Australian band called The Church. I happen to be friends with the lead singer, but his two guitarists in previous incarnations of the band, Marty Wilson Piper and Peter Kopez, or Marty Wilson Piper actually used a Rickenbacker 12-string. Rickenbacker, and if you know songs like "Almost With You" and "Unguarded Moment," and the Rickenbacker features beautifully in those songs.
Yeah,
fantastic,
beautiful guitars.
So apparently, you composed at the 1999 Rugby League Grand Final.
I conducted. Yeah,
I'm not sure if you're aware. Me and Tom are avid rugby league fans.
Yes.
And to my misery, my favourite team was in that grand final.
So we're talking Melbourne versus St George.
That's it.
Right. Oh, boy. I'm guessing you're St George. Ouch.
We are living in Brighton.
Sorry about that.
Tough times. Do you follow rugby league?
I do follow rugby league. Don't hold this against me, but I like the Roosters.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry about that.
Where's Peter Menezes?
Where's Pete? There's a reason. In 1974... a friend of my father was not into rugby league, but a friend of his was, and he was a Canterbury Bulldogs supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And he had tickets to the 1974 grand final, which was Bulldogs. Were they the Berries?
Yeah.
Canterbury versus, it was the Eastern Suburbs Roosters at the time. And my father's friend says, I've got tickets. Would you like to go?" My father said, "No, I don't like rugby league." But I've got an older brother. He said, "But my son," and he was talking about my brother, "my son might like to go."
Mm.
And he said, "Actually, I've got a second ticket, you know." And I said, "I'll go." I didn't know what I was going to, but I went to the Sydney Cricket Ground, and right on the fence, and I'm watching Mark Harris run toward me, score a try, and Russell Fairfax and Ian Schubert.
He had a great nose, that guy, didn't he?
He did, Russell Fairfax. And so that was the 1974 grand final, and Roosters won. And so I thought, I like this game. I like the Roosters. So then I went to the 1975 grand final. Oops, I shouldn't have mentioned that. You're a St. George.
Here we go. Lang Lance. It was the white boots.
My God. So, I'm a Rooster. Sorry about
that. Am I right in saying that you arranged last year's grand final as well?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so here's the thing then, George.
Yes.
Every time you arrange something for a grand final, one of our teams loses.
For your sake, I'm not doing any more arranging.
Please don't do any more, George.
If the Dragons or the Rabbitohs make the grand final, sorry about that. Maybe stay away.
Sorry about that. Oh my God, I'm amongst Rabbitohs and Dragons. I bet there's no more ouzo for me.
We love you. You think you're drinking ouzo? No.
Cyanide.
No, classic.
I loved doing the music to last year. Unfortunately, I couldn't go because I was in Brisbane.
Yep. Yeah.
Sorry, it was in Brisbane and I was stuck here. I couldn't get over the border. But we recorded it all here in Sydney and then we transferred it over to Brisbane. But it was Ian Moss from Cold Chisel. Yeah. He did Tucker's Daughter, so we did an orchestral arrangement of that. Mm-hmm. And then we also did Flame Trees, which is also a Cold Chisel song, of course, as we know.
It was beautiful.
But it was sung by Kate Miller-Heidke, a wonderful Australian pop singer, operatic singer as well, and she did it as a duet with Ian Moss, and I just really, really loved it. I've got to tell you a story about that.
Yeah, please. Definitely.
So, without getting too much in the nitty gritty, it was suggested to me, it was recommended to me that we do Flame Trees. Mm-hmm. Now, and it was going to be a duet with Kate Miller-Heidke and Ian Moss. The problem was, and they all agreed to it. It was great. The problem was that Ian Moss sings in a different key to Kate Miller-Heidke. So I had to work out a way where we could start in her key, but then surreptitiously, you know, inconspicuously morph, modulate exactly into Ian Moss's key. And we did that, but he was in Brisbane, so we had to do this all digitally and online and on Zoom and, you know, audio, not in person in the same room. He was brilliant, but he was finding it difficult to find his note because as we modulated, we didn't want to make it an obvious modulation because then it would sound like, oh, you've just done this because he's in a different key. So we wanted to do it really, really inconspicuously. But we did it so inconspicuously that he found it hard to find his note.
Wow.
And even on the morning of the actual thing, because they were singing live, even though the orchestra was pre-recorded, they were singing live and he emails me on the day of the grand final and says, I'm still finding difficult to find a note. And I'm going, oh no, what am I going to do? So I send him things, you know, listen out for this. The conductor there will give you a cue. The moment comes and I stop breathing and I'm there with my partner. I'm going, oh, okay, find a note. Come on here. 1, 2, 3. And he sang it and I jumped for joy and I did a dance for the next 5 minutes. I missed the rest of the song. Luckily, I've seen it since on recording. But it was such a moment, a heart-stopping moment for me, but we got it.
Wow. So
it's good. Brilliant. I'd like to say that I'm going to go back and watch it, but I can't watch anything from that day.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
No. Have to cut and paste that clip out for you.
But you know what? That was a fantastic performance. You did a fantastic job putting all of that together.
Thank you. I loved doing that one. Thank you.
You want to know more about Hugh Jackman? So, 99.
Yes, he sang This Is the Moment.
Perfect. Mm. So, what's he like? Is he Greek?
No, he's not Greek.
I heard somewhere.
His grandmother's Greek, apparently.
Is that right? I didn't know he's got that.
A grandparent or great grandparent.
Oh, well, then, you know, if they say if you're any part Greek, you're Greek.
It's a dominant gene. Just takes over.
We'll have him.
Look, I didn't know that, I must admit. But in answer to your other question, he's a beautiful man.
Mm.
Smiley, supportive, interested in you. Like, you know, he'll go to the most junior member of the orchestra or the choir and say, how long have you been learning your instrument? You know, he's this worldwide star that goes up to a 17-year-old and says, what's that? That's a bassoon, isn't it? How do you learn how to play that? And I'm like, wow, what a lovely man. Yeah. No, he was beautiful. Yeah.
Just seems like he can't, it's nothing he can't do. He can sing, he can act, and he's physically fit and strong and champion bloke.
Yeah.
So what was your role in the 99 grand final?
We did the orchestral and the choral backing to This Is the Moment,
beautiful.
It was just a really lovely experience, a lovely man. Unfortunately, I haven't, you know, I get to work in his circles all the time, so I haven't seen him since, but he was that was a really, really nice moment. And you know, people, when they say to me, oh, it's great that you're doing the NRL, I said, I've every time I work for the NRL, it's apart from your sides losing the grand final, which I'm very sorry about, it's just that the NRL are really, really great people. They They really look after us very well. So I hope I get to do it again.
Yeah, well, it's run by Greeks, would you believe?
Yeah, no, it's run by
Peter Greeks. Valandis?
Of course, yeah.
Who else we got, Tom? We got a few of them.
High-profile Greeks in rugby league, as many as you want. Nick Politis, Nick Pappas.
Nick Pappas, and I went to university together for a year. Yeah, he's a lovely man.
He is a lovely man, actually. Mm. We're hoping to get him on the podcast. So
he'll be a wonderful guest.
Fantastic. And you've done a bit of work with Kelly Clarkson, I believe.
Kelly Clarkson sang at the 2011 Grand Final.
Okay.
And we did, for that performance, we also did an arrangement of Kashmir by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
she is Greek, by the way.
Kelly Clarkson is Greek.
Yes, she is. She's another one.
Yep. The Greekness in the we're everywhere. Famous people.
There's some sort of connection you didn't realise. So.
Yeah, she's definitely Greek.
Right, there you go. Has she changed her name or?
I'm not sure, actually.
I think it's her mother's side. Mm. Yeah. It's Greek.
Mm-hmm.
But you just had a look. Hugh Jackman, I think it's his great-grandfather that was Greek.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but he mentioned it in Wikipedia. So I guess he's...
If he's any part Greek, he's fully Greek.
Yeah. Well, he looks Greek. Looks like an Adonis, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, mate. We'll have him.
He's tall, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
he towered over me.
Composition-wise, I mean, obviously you do composing work as well.
Mm.
Writing for TV, film, and whatnot. What sort of projects have you worked on?
I've worked on the music to a movie called Ladies in Black with a director called Bruce Beresford. It's name dropping, I know, but we happen to be good friends. I met him on a movie set for a movie that he was directing called Mao's Last Dancer.
Fantastic film.
A friend of mine who's a composer called Chris Gordon, I was doing a concert with an Australian band called Augie March with the Western Australian Symphony Orchestra, and that concert got on TV. And Chris Gordon, one of Chris Gordon's arrangements were part of that concert. So mm-hmm. he watched it on TV and he hadn't met me, but he was watching me conduct. And at the time, I had longer hair than I have. And he was writing the music to Mao's Last Dancer, the movie by Bruce Beresford. And they needed a conductor who looked like they were from the 1970s. And so Chris said, "Oh, look, I've seen you on TV. I've seen you on TV. Would you please come and be a conductor on the movie on the set of Mao's Last Dancer?" I said, "Sure." And on that set, I met the director Bruce Beresford, and so he lived near me, and he invited me over to his New Year's Eve party, and I saw we're standing on his balcony, and I see two kayaks. He goes, "Do you kayak?" I said, "No." He said, "Would you like to?" So we did the next day, and we became good friends. And so then he was writing directing a movie called Ladies in Black about a few years later after Mao's Last Dancer, and he said, "Would you please come and help me with the music of this movie, be a music supervisor, write some of the music for it?" So they're the kinds. That's one of the projects I've done in film. I've also, there's a wonderful recording studio in Sydney called Trackdown Studios. It's in Fox Studios.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes like Japanese animated movies do their orchestral recording here. So we put an orchestra together and I go and conduct the orchestra for that. So that's the kind of thing we do in film.
It's such an interesting area as well. I mean, you think about some of the names that people know about in terms of scoring films and TV and whatnot. I mean, you're talking about Hans Zimmer at the moment, who I understand you've had some kind of a connection with.
Yeah, I put an orchestra together for him for his 2017 tour.
Wow. So yeah, Hans Zimmer, John Williams, my God, Danny Elfman, all of these guys. Are these people that you look up to or look to for inspiration?
Oh, absolutely. Danny Elfman, I think, is an amazing musician, composer.
Mm.
I mean, you probably know he was in a band called Oingo Boingo.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful song by Oingo Boingo. I mean, they had Weird Science, of course, but there's another song called, is it something about staying the night? I can't remember the name of the song, but it's One More Night or something like that. It's called, it's a beautiful song. So here is this lead singer of a pop band recording and performing pop music. And then you see, when my kids were young, I used to watch The Simpsons and music by Danny Elfman. I'm going, Danny Elfman, that was the lead singer of Oingo Boingo. And then you see a movie like Beetlejuice, music by Danny Elfman, etc., etc. Wow. He's quite a phenomenal man. Yeah, so, yes, they definitely are inspirations. And Hans Zimmer, I mean, you know, speaking of Bruce Beresford, there's a connection there. Hans Zimmer wrote the music to Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, right.
So, these people are definitely...
Unbelievable. He did the music to Gladiator, didn't he?
He did music. You're right, he did Gladiator. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So remember, I think you mentioned earlier what music does to me. That was one of the soundtracks I'd listened to when I was at work at my desk. Mm. It was a beautiful piece.
Yes, because when we performed with Hans Zimmer, I toured with him around Australia in 2017, we had... We did the music to Gladiator, and we had the Australian female singer that sang it originally in the recording.
Mm. Wow. Fantastic. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there are actually a lot of great Greek composers as well. You think about Vangelis.
Chariots of Fire.
Chariots of Fire. Yeah. Amazing. And did you know he was actually in a band called Aphrodite's Child, the lead singer of which was?
Nobody.
Demis Roussos.
No.
Kidding.
Yes. Really?
And they were brilliant.
What a connection.
They were brilliant.
Yeah. And what about his collaboration with John Anderson, Vangelis and John Anderson? They did something together. I can't remember the actual song. Long Way Home or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just, quite incredible. Vangelis is amazing.
Well, I think that's a good segue, though. I mean, getting back onto the Greek stuff, what's your connection with Greek music? You know, traditional music and maybe popular Greek music. Obviously, you've done a lot of concerts recently, most recently with Basis, when he was out here, I think, last year or the year before.
Yeah, last year with him, which is Basis, yeah.
What's your connection? Did you listen to Greek music growing up?
I did. I listened to Greek music, but... You know, because my friends weren't listening to it, you know, they were playing Australian, English, American music. That's what I predominantly listened to. But the way that I, other than the Olympics, the way that I got into Greek music was I was working for an orchestra at, in the 2012 period. And this orchestra was run by an Armenian lady, and she, as well as programming Mozart and Schubert and Beethoven, she wanted me to program Armenian composers like Khachaturian and other such composers. Oh. And so we did quite a bit of music in concerts by these composers. But I said to her, look, I've got Greek background. I want to do some Greek music. Mm. And she said, sure, if you can do some Greek concerts if you like. So I did a Greek concert and I programmed a Greek concert and I called my friend George Dukas and I said, we're doing music by Theodorakis, etc. Mm. It needs bouzouki. Will you come and please play bouzouki with us?
Wow.
I arranged all this. I did these orchestrations of music by Theodorakis, etc. that I had a working knowledge of, and he helped me with that. And he said... I'd like to invite Nia Carteris to this concert. Mm. She's involved with the Greek Festival of Sydney. Yeah. This was in 2013, and so we did this concert, and Nia likes it, and she says, "We've got to do this same concert in the Greek Festival of Sydney."
Yeah.
So in 2014, we hired the Great Hall at Sydney University, and we did this concert full of music by these Greek composers that we arranged specifically. We went down like a charm, and she said, next year I want to do Axionisti, this great oratorio for large choir, orchestra, vocal soloists, piano, etc., for the Greek Festival of Sydney. So they hired the City Recital Hall at Angel Place, and we performed Axionisti, and they brought over a wonderful Greek singer from Athens called Vasilis Lekas.
Mm.
And it was a major hit.
Wow.
And that's when I, in answer to your question, kind of, that's when I really got stuck into Greek music.
Right.
I mean, I know there's all different types. You know, there's the rebetika, there's the popular, there's Anavisi, there's Pegizina, who I love, by the way. I love Pegizina. Do you know a song by her called Moulipis?
Yes.
I love that song. I saw her perform it in Athens at a bouzouki. Yep. Anyway, in Glyphada. But so Axionisti was a major hit. And so then next, so near says, okay, what are we going to do next year? So I chose Gioconda's Smile by Manos Hatzidakis. Yeah. And then in the second half, we performed songs, orchestral arrangements I did of Stavros Xarhakos' music. Mm-hmm. And I love Stavros Xarhakos. It's got songs like Aspri Medake Yamas, gorgeous songs. Yeah. And for that, we brought out, or the Greek Festival of Sydney brought out Dimitris Bassis.
Yeah.
So I really got into these Greek composers who had orchestral leanings. We had Xarhakos, we had Hatzidakis, we had Theodorakis, of course.
Yeah.
And then we also did a piece of his, piece by Markopoulos as well.
Mm.
That's, in answer to your question, that's my connection. That's my main connection with Greek music. I mean, you know, when I'm in Athens, or when I was in Athens last anyway, my cousin said, okay, we're going to Bouzoukia. And there was a person by the name of Plutarchos, who I hadn't heard of before.
Yeah.
You know, and he's performing, and then the Pegasina comes on and sings and sings Moulipis. I'm going, okay, I know I delve into in the orchestral world, but this is great as well. You know, it's like liking Beethoven, but also liking the Beatles. You know, it's just a world of beauty.
Where do you place like the Greek composers and the Greek musicians in the scheme of things? Because I find that difficult to do. You know, because obviously you've got the, you know, sort of the mainstream Western music that we're all accustomed to.
Yeah.
But then we as Greeks have this extra, we've also got this music as well.
Yeah.
How does someone like Theodorakis or some of these other composers compare with, dare I say, a Vivaldi or a Mozart or whatever?
It's a very good question. So if you're talking about Vivaldi or Beethoven or Mozart, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a piece of classical music that starts as classical music, ends as classical music, and in the middle is classical music.
Yeah.
If you're going to have a band, I don't know, Beatles, In Excess, whoever, Australian Crawl, it's going to start as pop music, it's going to end as pop music, and in the middle is pop music.
Yeah.
Then you get to Theodorakis.
Yeah.
And this piece that I mentioned called Aksionisti, it's wild. It starts with this esoteric orchestral, because it's the genesis, like the birth of humankind. And then it goes into out-and-out classical, like Beethoven or Vivaldi, etc. And then a singer, a pop singer, stands, and we do Ena to Chelidoni, which is as pop as anything in Western culture. And there's all this mix.
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, okay, so I said Australian Crawl before. That's a band with drums and bass. Mm-hmm. And I said Beethoven before, or Vivaldi, and that's a symphony orchestra, strings and woodwinds, etc. But in Aksionisti, you get the band, you get the symphony orchestra, you get bouzoukia, you get drums and bass, you got choir.
Yeah.
Get it
it's
all.
The gamut. So it's phenomenally different and above all of those things.
It just seems so strange. Artists sort of sit down and they have, you know, some limitations, you know, in order to keep them focused. How does someone like that decide, I'm going to use all of these colors in the palette and come up with such a diverse repertoire? It's unbelievable.
If I knew, I would have done it.
It's a good point.
No, he was a genius.
And to write something like Zorba, it's stereotypical in some respect, but
he was a total genius. I mean, you know, there's Mozart, total genius. There's Paul McCartney, total genius. There's Mikis Theodorakis. Some people in this world, and I wish I was one, are geniuses.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. They just are. They're just brilliant.
I mean, you're obviously at the conservatorium in Sydney here. How do you teach people about someone like Theodorakis versus some of these more established or, you know, better known Western composers?
I think it's important to know that most people aren't geniuses.
Yeah.
You know, I'm certainly not, and it's good to know that you're not, because you have to learn. And people who aren't geniuses are actually better teachers because the geniuses haven't had to work on it. They haven't had to learn it. So that if they haven't had to learn it, they can't impart any knowledge.
It's hard to explain it.
You know, Mozart would have been a terrible teacher because he was writing symphonies when he was 5 years old.
Mm.
He was born with it.
Yeah.
Just like you're born with blue eyes or brown eyes, he was born being able to compose music. So if you've got that, you can't teach it. But if you've had to struggle to work hard to learn it, then you can teach it. So you just have to, when you're teaching, when I'm teaching at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, I just have to go on the fact that, you know, 99.9% of these people are not geniuses. So therefore, they're talented, especially when they work hard, but not geniuses. Therefore, you have to just make sure they put in the hard work, and that's how you learn.
Is it easy to identify a genius? So you're teaching 99.9%, but that 0.1% might be in the classroom.
Yeah.
Can you identify them? Have you?
Yes. On very rare occasions, I've identified geniuses. I've got an assistant at the moment, and the reason she's my assistant is she got a, you know, the highest distinction mark I've ever given of anybody. I've been teaching at the Conservatorium since early 1994. In all that time, maybe one.
Wow.
So the identification comes in, is just so natural for them. They're brilliant from, there are others that are brilliant towards the end of after you train them, but some come to you, go, okay, all right, you should be teaching me.
Wow. So what are the hallmarks? I mean, I'm assuming all of these people would have perfect pitch as a start.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, my assistant, has a perfect pitch, yeah.
Wow. Just explain for our listeners who don't understand, maybe, what is perfect pitch?
So, for example, if you say to somebody with perfect pitch, sing me a C-sharp, they can sing a note, la, whatever it is, and you go to the piano and it's a C-sharp. Well, that's perfect.
Unbelievable pitch. Skill. Unbelievable skill. I think we're sort of nearing the end here. So, George, just tell us briefly, what are you working on right now? Where can people see you? Where can they find out more information about what you're doing?
There's a fantastic company that I've been working for the last few years called Metropolis Touring, and they... talking about merging classical colours, orchestral colours, with pop music, they get these iconic artists, you know, international artists like George Michael and Fleetwood Mac and Beatles and Elton John, etc. And we put orchestrations together with these wonderful performers. And so we do Concert State Theatre. Last night we did a Fleetwood Mac. Next week we're doing a George Michael.
Fantastic.
And the next night we're doing David Bowie, and the week after, on the 4th of March, we're doing Elton John, and we just keep on doing these things like that.
Fantastic.
That, plus I'm also a guest conductor with the Canberra Symphony Orchestra, and there's a local Sydney artist, a great singer called Lior, and he's we're doing a concert of with him, with the Canberra Symphony. It's a free outdoor event for Canberra Day on the 13th of March. And because it's free and it's outdoors, 20,000 people come to this.
Yeah, wow.
Fantastic.
So that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing I'm doing. And also, I've also got some teaching at the Conservatorium. So my life is a little bit busy at the moment, but I'm not complaining. It's better than the alternative.
Well,
I mean, you know, we're living in a pandemic still, and I've got all this work, so I'm not complaining.
Well, just on that, before we finish, I mean, the pandemic hit the arts particularly hard. I mean, there's a lot of musicians, you know, who do what I do on the side, you know, playing pubs and clubs and whatnot, who weren't able to work and didn't really get any, you know, too much support from the government. Did you feel a lot of that, or did you feel that through the people that you work with?
I certainly felt it for the people that I work with, and I felt very bad for musicians who lost their income and livelihood during 2020 and 2021. Luckily, personally, I wasn't affected. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction to me, you mentioned I was a composer and an arranger, and I've got my conducting work. The conducting work stopped in 2020 and 2021, by and large. But because I've also got a composition and an orchestration background, I was able to continue that, and a teaching background. So my teaching at the Conservatorium continued throughout the pandemic online, but that was fine. So what I felt really much about was my colleagues who were violinists and orchestral players who earned their living from performing, who that stopped. Luckily, some of them were able to get some government funding, you know, and applications for funds, etc. So that was okay. But yeah, luck for me, I was okay. And as I said, these concerts are happening, and, you know, we're kind of, you know, hopefully we're getting out of this pandemic. I don't know, are we? It seems like it.
It feels like we are. And hopefully, particularly for the arts in Australia, I'm not sure what it's like in you know, for our listeners in the US and Canada and whatnot. But, you know, here, obviously, the arts have been hit quite hard. We obviously hope that that's changing now. And obviously for yourself, you're out there in the world now conducting again and doing concerts and whatnot at the State Theatre. We're happy to see that. We wish all of those musicians out there all the very best. And, mate, George, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a fantastic discussion.
Yeah, I don't want this to end. I'm sad that it's ending. I've loved talking with you. Thank you. Thank you for the insightful questions, and thank you for doing this and for your interest in people specifically, but also just generally in the arts, and the world needs more people like you.
Yeah, thank you so
fantastic,
much.
Fantastic. Very insightful. Thank you so much. And look, it's probably not going to end here, mate. We're going to crank up a barbecue. We'll definitely have to invite you back. Absolutely. We're actually going to have a barbecue after this. So
sounds great.
We can continue on.
There's still some wuzo left in this bottle, and we've got a whole bunch in there. So I think we're set for the rest of the afternoon.
Let me go down to the bottle shop to contribute.
No, that's fine, mate. That's all good. Lovely having you, mate, and amazing stories. Again, like you said, we could be talking for hours. You know, you're so insightful, and you're very Absolutely. Detailed the way you explain the story. It's fantastic.
You know, it's life has its compulsory things. You know, we have to, you know, we do our living, we pay our taxes, we get up and we have to do our jobs. Mm-hmm. But it's also about loving life and, you know, going on a holiday or swimming in the beautiful ocean or making music. And this whole thing is focusing on the beauty of life. So all blessings to you, power to you, to that you're focusing on, you know, talking to people about how life can be joyous, and don't we need to know how life can be joyous? So to you two and to your listeners, let's celebrate life, because life is worth celebrating.
Yeah,
very beautiful. Well said.
Well done, mate.
As the old Greeks would say, "Την ευχήμου να έχεις." George, thank you so much. And Nick, fantastic discussion, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love it. Look, fantastic. I learned so much. Again, I'm not musically minded as you two, but I feel like I am listening to you two speak.
Well, look, if you enjoyed this discussion, guys, send us an email at uzotalk@outlook.com or follow us on Instagram at uzotalk_talk. Or follow us on Facebook as well at UzoTalk. And we've also got a YouTube now as well, where we're putting a few videos. We'll probably put a couple of little snippets up on our YouTube from this discussion as well. Share it with your friends. If you've got Greek friends, relatives, whatever it may
be. Or musicians.
Musicians especially as well.
Yeah,
make sure you share this around.
Definitely. And if you've got any questions for us or for George, look right in and we'll forward them on. And anything you want to hear in the future, let us know, guys. But we love doing this, and the more comments and feedback we get, the better it is for everyone.
Absolutely. And just on that note as well, we've got some high profile guests coming up. We can't say exactly who just yet, but
can't wait.
We've promised.
So how is Hugh Jackman these days?
We wish.
We will be knowing, mate. We might have to talk
I last
about
saw him
this.
In 2011, so not so well anymore.
Let's see what happens. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Please share the podcast, leave your comments, send us emails, and we'll see you next time.
Definitely. Awesome. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
It's been
much.
Great.
See you next time.
Take care.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.